Iran says until the sanctions against the Islamic Republic are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more restraint and forbearance from Tehran. Tensions keep simmering between Moscow and the West, with Germany warning Russia of a heavy price if it threatens the sovereignty of Ukraine. And a French fisherman threatened to block the Channel Tunnel and Port of Calais in protest against Britain's post-Brexit fishing license policy. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. In our top story, Iran says it is first priority in the upcoming talks in Vienna is effective removal of all U.S. sanctions without further delay and any preconditions. At a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, Iran said the U.S. needs to address concerns about how its possible future adherence to the deal can actually be relied upon. From Vienna, Homolezgi reports.
Iran's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Ghaibi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Ghaibi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Iran and Iraq concluded the first session of a joint committee mandated to investigate the U.S. assassination of their top anti-terror commanders. A joint statement issued following a two-day meeting in Baghdad condemned the U.S. move as a serious crime, a human rights violation, and a breach of international law. It also called the assassination a violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. The panel pledged to take all the legal and judicial measures possible to bring the perpetrators and the orchestrators of this terror act to justice. Next session of the committee is slated to be held in Tehran within a month. Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes were assassinated in a U.S. drone strike at Baghdad airport in January of 2020. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has strongly denounced Australia for its decision to designate the movement as a terrorist organization. Mariam Saleh reports.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah denounced Australia's decision to list the whole group as a terrorist organization, saying it was, quote, a humiliating submission to American and Zionist dictates. In a statement, Hezbollah stressed that such a move will not affect its determination to support any anti-Israeli movement.
The timing is bizarre. The only thing that points to the timing is the visit by Israeli diplomats to Australia. That means that the Australians are abiding by a request by the Israelis. That is what this decision is all about. These are the indicators. Now, what repercussions does this decision have? I think that the Australian diplomats, and let me break it out to you, the Australian diplomats have been trying in the back door to have to be in touch with Hezbollah to actually say that there are no repercussions.
Australia on Wednesday extended a pre-existing ban on the movement's armed units.
The group continues to threaten terrorist attacks and provide support to terrorist organisations. Hence my intention to list the entirety of Hezbollah.
Observers believe the United States has been exerting all efforts with its allies to demonize Hezbollah, not only in the region, but across the globe.
It seems clear that the U.S. is facing a dilemma in the region, which is Hezbollah, and it is attempting to deal with this dilemma through a political course with Lebanon, in the region and beyond it. When we see that Australia takes such a decision, we can conclude that the U.S. is using all its arms and its tools in all spheres to face Hezbollah in a medium and long-term track.
Analysts agree that this comes only months preceding the Lebanese parliamentary elections in order to intimidate expats from going to the ballots, while it also puts pressure on Hezbollah's allies at home. Sources close to Hezbollah also expect to see similar moves from countries which have taken the U.S. path in their foreign policies. Hezbollah has long been targeted by the U.S., Israel, and their allies, but Hezbollah is a fully functioning political party within the Lebanese parliament and cabinet, and many fear that the recent move by Australia could impact diplomatic ties with Lebanon's government and further destabilize the country. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
6 months after Israel's all-out war on the besieged Gaza Strip, rights groups say that they are deeply concerned over the lack of reconstruction in the enclave. It also raised concerns about the ongoing humanitarian situation in Gaza. The tiny enclave is in crisis, and people there are paying the price of the international community's inaction. Ashraf Shannon has our story.
The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with UNRWA and the Palestinian Ministry of Public Works, held a workshop in the Gaza Strip to discuss Israel's latest destruction of hundreds of buildings during the May War. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, over 100,000 internally displaced persons, or IDPs, sought shelter and protection at UNRWA schools or with hosting families. Currently, there are still about 8,000 Palestinian IDPs, primarily those whose houses were completely destroyed or severely damaged during the one-ton Israeli bombardment.
The Israeli war in May caused massive destruction, especially to residential areas, and thousands of families have been internally displaced. The delay of reconstruction is a direct result of the Israeli blockade. Israel bans the entry of building supplies into the Gaza Strip in a direct and grave violation of the international law and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
People and businesses in the Gaza Strip are still waiting for the reconstruction to start. In addition to bombing thousands of buildings and infrastructure, Israeli regime forces also killed hundreds of innocent civilians, including women and children.
It was 7 p.m. on the last day of the holy month of Ramadan when the apartment building where I lived was bombed. Israeli warplanes first fired a drone rocket and minutes later hit the building with an F-16 bomb. My family is currently displaced and we are just lucky to be still alive. We call on all the world to help us rebuild our homes.
Over 2,200 Palestinians were also injured during the Israeli air raids, including 685 children and 480 women, some of whom may suffer a long-term disability requiring rehabilitation. Hundreds of Palestinian families have lost everything during Israel's May onslaught, and their plight has no end in sight.
My house was bombed on the morning of Eid al-Fitr around 5 a.m. It was a horrific scene beyond description. Can you imagine being with your wife and children preparing for the holiday, and all of a sudden your house is bombed and no longer have a place to call home?
Many Gazans had their lives shattered because of the recent war, and they still have no proper place to raise their families. Rights groups accuse donor countries of failing to fulfill their financial pledges to rebuild the tiny coastal territory and end the illegal and inhumane Israeli blockade. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The German chancellor has warned Russia over its troop buildup on the Ukrainian border. We discuss the issue in depth with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
Tensions escalating within Moscow and the West, with Germany warning Russia of a heavy price if it threatens the sovereignty of Ukraine.
On the second point, Ukraine, we will of course do everything we can to avoid further aggression, and that is the first task. It means that any further aggression against the sovereignty of Ukraine would carry a high price. That is totally clear.
Chancellor Angela Merkel says the European Union should be united against Moscow's troop deployment near eastern Ukraine. She says Russia must face further sanctions if it continues its, quote, weaponization of migrants against Poland. And meanwhile, the Ukrainian foreign minister has warned Moscow against any military action against his country.
Moscow must clearly understand what political, economic, and human losses it will incur in the event of a new stage of aggression. Ukraine stands for the set of comprehensive measures to counter the Kremlin's aggressive intentions. It includes political and economic restraint of Russia and military aid for Ukraine.
Dmytro Kuleba claims that the Kremlin is trying to dismantle the security architecture of Europe. Russia has repeatedly dismissed Western concerns about its troop buildup near the border with Ukraine. It says the increased military activity is a defensive move in response to the growing NATO presence near its borders. Moscow also denies any involvement in the current migrant crisis on the border between Poland and Belarus. Now that was the story. Now let's get some insight on this. So joining me will be Andrew Kartanov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council in Moscow, and also Greg Simons, author and geopolitical analyst, is joining us from Uppsala. Andrew, what's your assessment of the situation? Each side is blaming the other side. One is saying, I'm moving troops because of a NATO growing presence near Russian borders. The other side is Germany is threatening Russia, you know, about Ukraine's sovereignty and interconnection and all that. So who's to blame?
Well, we don't know what Mr. Putin has in mind, but my take is that if he really wanted to invade Ukraine, he would do it in a covert, closed way. And we wouldn't see an explicit, even demonstrative movements of troops along the Russian-Ukrainian border. We are no longer in 1914. You don't need weeks to mobilize troops. That can be done within a couple of days, maybe within a couple of hours. So my take is that it's not about a war. It's about sending a signal to Kyiv and maybe also to the West.
Greg, what's your assessment?
Well, part of a rather entire U.S. strategy, psychological operations through you. And there seem to be three objectives. One is to keep vassal and client states like Ukraine and Germany, that they retain their dependence on the United States. The second point is to tie up and restrict, that's obstruct Russia's foreign policy maneuvers or potential because of these crying wolf, where the intention is to put Russia on a passive and defensive stance. And the third one is for the United States to have its options on the contrary increased by holding a this not passive but rather active stance, which is putting the others and playing them as objects rather than subjects in this particular game.
Mm-hmm. And Andre, what do you expect to happen next? What's around the corner? Should we expect an escalation or easing of the situation?
Well, I think that definitely some tension will be there. And there might be risks of what I would call an inadvertent escalation. No one really wants a big war in the center of Europe. I think the collateral damage inflicted on both sides by this conflict might be huge, and both sides will have to pay a very high price for a military conflict there. But I think the danger is that they might get into an incident and then an escalation starts. Frankly, I'm even more concerned about the situation in the Black Sea rather than in East Ukraine, because in the Black Sea you have a lot of military activities, and there are no regulations that might somehow decrease the risks of such such a confrontation at sea. We've seen in some this unfortunate incident with the British warship Defender, and I think we went pretty close to a direct military conflict between Russia and a NATO country.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Andrei Kurtanov, Director General of the Russian International Affairs Council in Moscow, and Greg Simons, author and geopolitical analyst in Uppsala, joined us with their comments and insight.
In France, fishermen plan to block British vessels from the country's ports as a fishing rights dispute between Paris and London shows no sign of abating. An association for French fishermen says that ferry traffic will be blocked at three ports, including the port of Calais, for several hours Friday. It says that they also plan to stop freight traffic into the Channel Tunnel between France and the UK. The union describes the move as a warning shot in response to the UK's refusal to grant more licenses to French fishermen. Says that London's fishing license policy is provocative and disdainful.
This is our demonstration of the quality and ability of professional fishermen to mobilize in response to the UK's provocative, contemptuous, and humiliating attitude towards them. It is about a legitimate action to make our rights heard and to avoid British bad faith from continuing into other discussions to come.
London and Paris are at odds over the number of licenses granted to French fishermen as part of the Brexit deal. Under the deal, European fishermen who worked in British waters before Brexit are allowed to continue fishing there. Paris accuses Britain of not fulfilling its commitments and rejecting license requests for dozens of French fishing boats. Two sides have held several rounds of talks on the issue with no breakthrough. France has threatened to impose restrictions on British boats and goods if the talks fail. Thanks for joining in, and goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Aubrey Allegretti, Rowena Mason, Joanna Partridge, and Rob Davis. The piece is titled "Johnson Losing the Confidence of Tory Party After Rambling CBI Speech." Conservative MPs are increasingly worried about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's competence and drive after he gave a rambling speech to business leaders and was accused of losing his grip over a series of key policies from social care to rail. Senior members of his own Conservative Party said they needed Boris Johnson to get the government back on track after a disastrous two-week period amid dismay about his performance at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference, where he lost his place in his speech for about 20 seconds and diverted into a lengthy tangent about Peppa Pig. The Prime Minister was also facing a substantial rebellion over his social care proposals. Anger at the decision to scale back rail improvements for the north of England, and frustration over the government's failure to keep its promises on small boats crossing the Channel. It caps a difficult fortnight for the Prime Minister after he admitted he crashed the car into a ditch in his handling of the Owen Paterson lobbying scandal. Nervousness among Tory MPs about No. 10 Downing Street intensified after one Downing Street source told the BBC there was a lot of concern inside the building about the Prime Minister. It's just not working. Adding that the Cabinet needs to wake up and demand serious changes, otherwise it'll keep getting worse. A former Cabinet Minister also told The Guardian that there was an accumulation of things building up, really relating to his competence, and that is beginning to look very shaky after a pretty bad fortnight. He said it was unlikely to result in a leadership challenge while opinion polls were still fairly even between the Tories and Labour, but it could be problematic for Boris Johnson if that changes when an election is looming. Another senior backbencher said Boris Johnson's CBI speech had been a mess, while a third Tory MP said, "I thought today's performance was the most embarrassing by a Conservative Prime Minister since last week's Prime Minister's questions. Someone needs to get a grip. He's losing the confidence of the party." Another Conservative MP referenced the process by which MPs can submit letters of no confidence to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, saying, "It might not only be Father Christmas postbag filling up towards the end of the year. Sir Graham Brady could find he needs a bigger one too." The Prime Minister's speech on Monday, 22nd of November, met a frosty reception among business leaders over its lack of substantial policy. In a sprawling address, Boris Johnson lost his place and spent 20 seconds uttering "forgive me" three times as he shuffled the printed pages on his podium. He then revealed he had spent Sunday on a trip to Hampshire's Peppa Pig World, an amusement park dedicated to a children's cartoon character, using it for a series of digs at the BBC and at civil servants. He said the TV show, worth £6 billion, was rejected by the BBC and has now been exported to 180 countries. He added, "I think this is pure genius, don't you? No government in the world, no Whitehall civil servant, would conceivably have come up with Peppa Pig." Boris Johnson also imitated the sound of an accelerating car with grunts that the official Downing Street release transcribed as "room, room." And another point, he compared himself to Prophet Moses over his plan to help business invest in tackling climate change. The Prime Minister said, "I said to my official, the new Ten Commandments were that thou shalt develop industries like offshore wind, hydrogen, nuclear power, and carbon capture." After the speech, business leaders questioned the Prime Minister's focus. Mike Cherry, the national chair at the Federation of Small Businesses, said, Last week's HS2 announcement has left a lot of small business owners wondering if the government is already losing its way, not just in speeches, but with regards to levelling up in the round. After the speech, Boris Johnson was asked if he was okay by a journalist. The Prime Minister defended his performance at the CBI, saying, "I think that people got the vast majority of the points I wanted to make, and I thought it went over well." Monday evening, 22nd of November, around a dozen Conservative MPs from the 2019 intake glumly gathered in one of their parliamentary offices. They were said to be disappointed and disillusioned and shared discontent that Boris Johnson wasn't listening to feedback. Like business leaders, the main concern of Conservative politicians was Boris Johnson's failure to live up to expectations on policies such as levelling up, rail and social care. Up to 20 Conservative MPs were expected to rebel on changes to the social care cap on Monday night. Shortly after Boris Johnson's speech, the Labour Party leader Keir Starmer set out to business leaders what he called Labour's pro-business agenda, including closer trade and regulatory ties with the European Union. Keir Starmer said, "I think that sometimes, if I may say so, our party has come across as thinking that business is to be tolerated in some way, but not to be celebrated as a good in itself." The Labour leader told another gathering of the CBI's multi-venue conference, this one in Birmingham, he said, "That mindset has changed under my leadership."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of your own program The Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio. I'm Farman Ali Masumi and with me my wife
Razia Batulna Jafi. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. I'm so glad to be here to be part of this show, The Muslim Lady.
So we were discussing about the modesty in our social media. This is a very, very important topic.
Because, you know, many people, they don't even agree with it. They disagree. They say, how come you're talking about some limitation for presence of female women in social media? Because this is very sensitive, this topic, because women are sensitive too, because they don't want to have some restriction. They're always looking for freedom. That why restriction only for us? But I will reply, there are so many restrictions for royal families, very, you know, outstanding families. Because
celebrities.
Celebrities, they have more restriction compared to, you know, normal people. So if Allah is just giving you a special position and just putting you on that high rank and level, why you're objecting?
Complaining.
You have to be thankful to Allah. Oh Allah, thank you. I have more restrictions, you know, I have more code of uniform and some code of covering myself compared to male, because I have something.
Likewise, if a very famous company offers you a job with some restrictions and they offer you good salary and good pay, so everybody accepts it, yeah?
Exactly.
They do not, complain about its restrictions, because, you know, they say this is a blessing, this is a bounty for them.
So we need ma'arifa.
Yeah.
We need, we have to be very positive. You know, and this is again one of the biggest attack on Islam in Quran and teaching of Ahlul Bayt alayhi Islam, that whatever we say, they take it negatively.
Negative.
You know, if that is even, if, although it's a very positive, they say, no, we don't want this restriction at all. Why women? Always women. You know, I usually give this example. For example, gold, yeah, in Islam, yeah. Gold is haram, forbidden for men, yeah,
gents,
for, yeah, gents. Gents cannot use a gold, and women, they can use it. This is a very plus point. Gents are not objecting. They're saying, yeah, there is some, you know, maslahat, some wisdom behind it. But we, as a women, if the goal would be forbidden for us, we would, you know, protest, and we would have
complain
that why?
Yeah,
look, Islam is not, Islam is not fair about. Look, goal is something very nice that is just halal. So same thing goes when it comes to modesty and haya. So today, I think we are going to talk about the role models which we get
definitely.
In social media.
So like in real life, we have so many role models and we follow them, we follow their footsteps. Likewise, in social media also, we have to have some role models, yeah?
Automatically, we are having it. You know, like, we don't call them role model, but if you like someone, and if you keep watching that person, spending time with
you
that
subscribe,
person,
whoever you follow
and truly follow and spend time with that, you know, page and person, automatically you're adopting his or her characters, yeah? And you're just following practically. So that is
very, very whether you say
scary.
It's role model or not, it is. It becomes a role model for us. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about modesty in our social media.
Mr. Masoumi, you know, we don't have enough good, modest role models, you know, the variety for our young girls especially. So, because they don't have it, yeah, and maybe they are not that much interesting as the non-Muslim and non-healthy role models, yeah. So automatically they get attracted by them. And, you know, I love the way, the topic says, this is a danger, you know, the alarming point. Alarming, you know. Like, there's so big danger that you don't know to whom you are following. And you know, if you know that, that is very easy. If you don't know, then more dangerous, because you don't know. You are going very opposite track.
And unfortunately, we do not have good Muslim religious role models, especially female role models in social media. Yeah, unfortunately, those who are religious, they do not come in social media.
So what do you say? They should come?
In some areas, yes.
Which areas?
Yeah.
How?
Areas,
yeah. Can you just
define? For example, as you are doing tabligh, yeah, you can become a role model for youngsters. You know, you only post, you know, ahadith and with your videos and some pictures, you know. So you take care about all the modesty and all the limits and boundaries. our female youngsters, our girls, they need some role models. Definitely they need in social media. You know, if they don't find good role models, female role models, what they should do, you know, to whom they should follow. So I think Islam also has allowed, as much as you are caring about all the boundaries, all the limits.
So this is the very positive point of Islam. Yeah. Like Islam says, you have to come. You know, you can come. You are allowed
to
come.
Because in Islam, we have wajib-e-kifai. You know, some things are wajib, means upon every Muslim person is wajib. But if somebody offers it, that is enough, you know. For example, namaz-e-janaza. Yeah, it is wajib-e-kifai. If somebody offers it, so it is not wajib on other persons, other people.
For example, if we need a surgeon, doctor. So if we have enough doctors in our society.
So it is not wajib.
Yeah, but if we don't have
in our society, they need a surgeon, but they don't have any surgeon. So it is wajib upon each person of that society, It is wajib. Means if they do not become surgeons, so they are doing haram, you know.
Yeah, they can do it easily. If they can study, they have to study.
Likewise, in social media also, we have so many, you know, responsibilities. If we do not come and feed them, definitely they will follow the wrong role models. They will go astray. Yeah, so we have to be careful about these things. I think it is also somehow like wajib-e-kifai,
to come. But nowadays we don't have enough good, for example, mostly for teenagers or for very young, like young role models, Muslim, modest, and balanced. You know, everything should be there. Modern, modest, balanced, and it's not necessary that you have to be a preacher, but you can come in any field, healthy field. For example, maybe you are a chef, you are cooking something.
You are a doctor, you are a trainer, you are a gym trainer, whatever you
are
doing.
But indirectly, you are giving this message of modesty and haya. Like the way you are talking to them, you know, your style of approaching to your audience is very, very important. You know, the way you talk, the way you walk. Like, for example, there's a hadith from Imam Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. He says that women, if she's walking on the street, it's better if she walks from the corner and from the wall side. But like, if she's walking from the middle of the street, her whole figure is very obvious. Everyone can, you know, easily from far can
look
see.
Look at the beauty.
Yeah. Half of her body is towards wall. She's not that clear.
So we are talking about modesty, for especially for a Muslim lady, because our program's name is Muslim Lady.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We are talking about modesty in our social media.
I love it. Even when we will die, when people are burying us, so the way we put the female, you know, dead body inside the graveyard is different from the way we put the gents, you know. Like, why? Because of modesty, you know. Even, you know, sometimes I say that when we are praying every day, you know, we are practicing as a female, as a Muslim lady, every single day when I'm performing my wuzu for Salah after Azan, I have to search for my scarf, for my chador. You know, that is a practice, So it's not an easy, you know, task. It's a very, very, very crucial and very important. So modesty of women is very important. So we have to put it in social media in a very positive and modern way. So we need plenty of role models, if they are using it in a healthy, and perfect modest way, then our female youngsters can go, inshallah, towards them.
And above all, our females, they are lucky. They have role models such like, you know, Fatimatu Zahra, Salamullah Alayha, Hazrat Zainab, Salamullah Alayha. So these are also, you know, the biggest role models.
But we don't know how to bring them.
Follow them.
Yeah, yeah. Follow them on social media. I remember a guy, a white non-Muslim guy, a Christian guy, he was telling in this month of Muharram that I don't know why this Muslim, they have written very less about Lady Zainab, Salamullah Alayha.
Yeah,
why? You know, we don't write in modern way. Writing means, you know, even e-book and on social media, some articles or some nice, you know, programs. So we are lacking, unfortunately. But I think the solution, if you want to share something, that if I'm a young Muslim lady, yeah, and I'm addicted with social media, I don't know how to control it. I'm just misusing it. So what do you tell me? From where should I start?
You know, definitely if talking about a young girl, so it is difficult for her to, you know, control these things. Definitely she needs a guide, like her parents or teacher or whoever is an alim. So they can provide her, you know, the guidelines, they can guide them, her. But as a youngster, as a young girl, it is very, very hard nowadays. You know,
she's coming towards you by this program, the Muslim lady, yeah? For example, I'm 21 years old, and I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I don't understand that how can I'm just wasting my time, yeah? And I'm just misusing the social media, and I'm not looking for that, you know, modesty chapter. So I'm listening to this program to change
definitely
my
there are a lot of factors. You know, the number one factor is you have to be aware about the, you know, presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to, you know, stay away from the sins. Mm-hmm. We have to always remind ourselves that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is with us in our social media, in our mobile, in our iPad. If we remind ourselves that our Creator, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, is with us, so it helps us, you know, then we feel shy, you know, while
so alhamdulillah, sins. Yeah, I get to know the first step is
awareness.
Yeah. So now time is over. So the second step, we are going to talk, inshallah, in our next episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I hope our listeners also enjoying this discussion. Inshallah, until next episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something to happen. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A jury in Virginia decided on Tuesday, 23rd of November, that a who's who of U.S. white supremacist leaders and hate groups should pay more than $25 million in damages to plaintiffs who said they suffered physical or emotional injuries during the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. The article you're about to hear has been written by USA Today journalists Will Carlos and Kevin McCoy, with a contribution from the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Jury Awards Plaintiffs $25 million in Lawsuit Against White Supremacists Behind Violence in Charlottesville Unite the Right Rally. Jury in Virginia decided on Tuesday, 23rd of November, that a who's who of U.S. white supremacist leaders and hate groups should pay more than $25 million in damages to plaintiffs who said they suffered physical and emotional injuries during the deadly Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. Though the jury found the defendants liable under a Virginia conspiracy law, the seven white and four black jurors were unable to reach a verdict on whether the defendants were liable under a federal statute that outlaws conspiracies to commit racially motivated violence. Coming after a third day of deliberations, the decision showed the jurors rejected defense arguments that the trial represented a referendum on free speech rights. The jurors imposed $500,000 each in punitive damages against several defendants and $1 million each against several organizations under state conspiracy claim. They limited compensatory damages on that claim to no more than $1 each. The jury found that lawyers for the plaintiffs proved a claim of racial or religious violence under Virginia law. The panel awarded two plaintiffs $250,000 each in compensatory damages and $200 each in punitive damages to be paid by several defendants. The jury imposed $12 million in punitive damages against James Alex Fields, a self-professed neo-Nazi who drove a car into the Charlottesville crowd, killing Heather Heyer. He was convicted of murder and sentenced to life imprisonment for the most indelible moment of violence during the rally. The case represented the latest in a decades-long strategy of plaintiffs using civil lawsuits to hobble hate groups by attacking their finances. It's unclear whether the Charlottesville defendants would be able to pay. The split verdict came one day after jurors sent a note to U.S. District Court Judge Norman Moon, saying they had been unable to reach unanimous decisions under federal conspiracy claim. The judge thanked the jurors for their service on Tuesday and assured them that a courtroom sketch artist's drawing of the verdict's delivery would not show their faces or other identifying characteristics. This case has sent a clear message. Violent hate won't go unanswered. There will be accountability, said Amy Spitalnik, executive director of Integrity First for America, which organized the lawsuit. The 9 plaintiffs still intend to get a verdict under federal conspiracy claim by refiling the case, said Roberta Kaplan, one of the attorneys who represented the group. No one will ever bring violence on the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, ever again, because they know what will happen if they do, Roberta Kaplan said. Richard Spencer, a former leader of the white supremacist and white nationalist movement called the alt-right, did not respond to a message seeking comment on the outcome of the trial, in which he represented himself. The case focused on 2 days in August, 4 years ago, 2017, when hundreds of white supremacists descended on Charlottesville, Virginia. They marched with lit tiki torches and chanted, "Jews will not replace us." Fights broke out between white supremacists and counter-protesters. The groundbreaking lawsuit was filed shortly after a rally by Charlottesville residents who said they had been injured in the violence. The plaintiffs included a minister and a number of students. Several defendants are leaders of the extremist right, including Christopher Cantwell, a neo-Nazi podcaster who is serving a prison sentence for extortion. White nationalist Jason Kessler, the Charlottesville rally's chief organizer, and Nathan D'Amigo, a white supremacist who founded the group Identity Europa. Attorneys for the plaintiffs argued that evidence showed the defendants planned the rally knowing violence would ensue. The defendants, 24 individuals and organizations, acknowledged espousing racist and anti-Semitic views, but denied they had conspired. The plaintiffs brought the case to trial under the federal Ku Klux Klan Act, a Reconstruction-era statute that allows individuals to sue when violent conspiracies deprive them of their constitutional rights. The law was enacted after Klan violence prevented newly freed slaves from exercising their rights as full citizens. The plaintiffs had to prove not only that their injuries resulted from the Unite the Right rally, but that the defendants had been involved in a conspiracy to commit racially motivated violence that caused those injuries. In an effort to do so, they relied on a trove of evidence, including hundreds of text messages among the defendants and hundreds of thousands of leaked communications from Discord, a messaging platform that many of the organizers of the rally in Charlottesville used leading up to the event. Throughout the trial, the defendants remained unapologetic about their racist beliefs. Some used the courtroom as a stage to praise Nazi leader Adolf Hitler or mock the Holocaust. During the closing arguments in the courtroom, a lawyer for the defense played a neo-Nazi recruitment video. The defendants sought to disassociate themselves from the central planning of the event and argued that they never intended for the rally to get violent. In his instructions to jurors about the conspiracy claim, District Judge Moon said they must agree only that a preponderance of evidence showed there was a mutual understanding, either spoken or unspoken, between the conspirators to commit at least one unlawful act. Spencer expressed regret for the events and for Heather Heyer's death. He and Cantwell tried to cast the trial as a referendum on First Amendment rights. District Judge Moon, who presided over the trial over more than 3 weeks, cut off those arguments and admonished the defendants to stick to the facts of the case. Lawyers for the plaintiffs produced evidence designed to show that the defendants conspired in planning the rally, knew it would descend into violence, and celebrated when it did descend into violence. The attorneys showed videos of the defendants discussing how well the rally went. Other evidence included communications and social media posts from the defendants talking about what equipment they would bring to Charlottesville and signaling they might hurt anyone who showed up to oppose them. "We are raising an army, my liege, for free speech, but for the cracking of skulls if it comes to it," read one of the text messages between co-defendants Kessler and Spencer. Plaintiff's attorney Michael Block noted a Facebook post in which Cantwell wrote, "If you think the alt-right is insignificant, you might want to ask the communist filth we send to the morgue and hospitals how insignificant we are." During cross-examination, attorney Michael Block asked Cantwell, "When you said the communists we sent to the morgue, you meant Heather Heyer?" "Yes," Cantwell replied. The lawsuit follows a successful decades-long tradition of using civil courts to decimate white supremacists and hate groups. Spencer said before the trial that the case had been financially crippling. In the 1980s and 1990s, the Southern Poverty Law Center used several chapters of the Ku Klux Klan on behalf of plaintiffs who had been intimidated or threatened. The lawsuits caused those chapters to file for bankruptcy or to shut down. The plaintiffs previously won default judgments against 7 of the 24 defendants. The plaintiffs' lawyers moved to enter those judgments formally after Tuesday, 23rd of November's split verdict was announced. The court has issued five-figured fines against 3 other defendants for failing to produce evidence or show up for court hearings or depositions, court files have shown.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.